Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. And once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest, skate punk originator and god from the faction, from Odd Man Out, from Soda, and from the brand new band Urethane, Steve Caballero is here. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. I love you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do, buddy, and everything, but, you know, the hard work too. If you want to get in touch with me directly, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram @left4damian. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is just by telling all your friends about it. You can also head over to where you subscribe or listen to this thing, and we'll subscribe to it and rate it. And that helps. And if you want to help even more, head over to patreon.com/turnedoutofpunk. And thank you to everyone that does do that and support the show. It could not happen without all of you. And speaking of support and thanks, this show would not be possible without the kind support of the fine folks at Vans, who I've known for a long time, and a few years ago said, Damian, we like this podcast. We just don't want you to have to do it out of your own pocket. And they helped me cover the cost of this thing. And for that, I cannot thank them enough. And hopefully one day I'll be doing those live House of Vans parties again, because that's a huge thrill. I can't wait to do that. Speaking of things that I cannot wait to do, I play in a band called Fucked Up, and we will be going on tour in outdoor venues with a band called Faith No More. Legends, Faith No More. You can find out more information on the internet. Just search Fucked Up Faith No More Tour, and you will find the dates for that thing, as well as other information, including Fucked Up is putting out a bunch of new records or reissues of records. We are finally putting out Epics in Minutes on Get Better Records, our original singles compilation, which has never come out on vinyl. Finally, it is coming out. Could not be happier about being part of the Get Better family. And, finally people stop asking me if that thing's ever going to come out on vinyl. Also coming out on vinyl is Year of the Horse, Fucked Up's hour and a half long song. It is coming out on Tank Crimes Records. It's a beautiful package put together by our buddy Scotty Karate over there at Tank Crimes, and you can check that out. And finally, Matador Records, our old label, will be reissuing David Comes to Life for the 10th anniversary of David Comes to Life. And in January, in theory, we will be traveling all over the place to play David Comes to Life. But for now, pre-order that record over there at Matador Records. And I think that's it. All right, on to today's show. Today on the show, a bona fide legend from not one, but two worlds. First of all, you cannot talk about skateboarding without talking about Steve Caballero. He originated Trix. He's one of the original members of the Bones Brigade. He is a pioneer of skateboarding. But lesser talked about, but still talked about, is the fact that Steve Caballero is a punk rock god. He has played in a bunch of bands, you know, like not only the Faction, who are one of the original skate punk bands, but he also played in Odd Man Out, Shovelhead, Soda. He did some solo stuff, but also super tough, super cool tough guys he did as well. And finally, a brand new band called Urethane. And Urethane has a new record called Chasing Horizons, which is coming out on September 24th on Cybertrax. And this just continues Steve's legacy. Steve Caballero is not a guy who's obsessed with like just one era or one sound within punk rock. He's into the whole thing. And you can tell when you look at his oeuvre, to put it pretentiously, because he's done stuff in all different styles. And we talk about this on the show. I don't think I need to ramble on anymore for this one. This is a fun conversation with a legend. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Steve Caballero on Turned Out a Punk. Steve, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, I'm a big fan and waited in a long line years ago at the Warped Tour and met you. And I actually asked you back then if I could interview you for my zine, and you said, of course. I unfortunately never did the zine.
Yeah.
Here we are 20 some odd years later, and I have a podcast like every other asshole. So welcome to the podcast.
Hey, no problem. So what city was it that we met?
We met in the at Buffalo, at the Buffalo stop of the Warped Tour. I'm from Toronto, but we drove down for the second day of the Warped Tour because we just could not get enough of long lines and expensive water.
Nice. Those were good times.
Oh, it was an amazing time for me. Those are like, you know, I think, you know, looking back on it now, it's amazing how, especially in the last year or so, how much I appreciate those kind of mass events and I long for a return to those. But I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Steve, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Well, what got me into punk was basically getting into rock and roll first. I grew up on the east side, south side of San Jose, which was predominantly African-American, Hispanic. So the music choices back then were probably like R&B, soul, disco. Wasn't much rock floating around, you know, and it wasn't until I got into skateboarding around 1976 and went to one of my very first skateboard parks around 1978. I kind of discovered rock and roll, bands like Led Zeppelin, Cheap Trick, Aerosmith, AC/DC. And because I wanted to be a skateboarder, because I wanted to fit into what the skateboarders were listening to, I went to Tower Records and had my mom buy me some rock and roll, you know. And then from there, it's kind of spawned off quickly kind of into new wave. A lot of skateboarders started listening to like new wave, so like Devo and B-52s, Gary Numan, The Missing Persons. And then I want to say around 1979 1980, the Ramones came around, the Sex Pistols came around, Dead Kennedys, and then I started listening to like B-52s. You know, from then I started going to shows and I heard of bands like Black Flag, Circle Jerks, the Adolescents, TSOL. And I just started getting into that kind of music. And that's when I felt like skateboarding and punk rock were kind of going hand in hand. And that's kind of where the direction of the music genre was heading, because it kind of really fit the lifestyle of a skateboarder. It being very DIY and very, especially when all the skate parks closed, we kind of went kind of underground and tried to find our own skate spots, built our own ramps and actually make our own zines. You know, I made a zine back in 1981 called Skate Punk, which,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And it was, you know, Xerox copied pictures and it had to do with like finding skate spots and going to shows. I was going to a lot of shows, with the friends from the skate park. And then around 1982, I decided I want to start playing music. And that's when we started the band, The Faction, and was based around skaters that skated at Winchester Skate Park with me and learn how to play instruments, and we got together and started that band.
Is that the first instance of skate punk? Like, did you coin that term?
I think so.
I think so too.
Because, like, you know, we were skaters and we were punkers, and like the skinheads hated us. You know, the guys in the oi bands didn't like us because we were skaters. You know, we weren't fully like leathered out with spiked hair and, you know, we were just, you know, skateboarders that liked punk. So
it's awesome when you look at it, like sort of the twin growths that are happening with skateboarding and punk rock at the same time. Like you're saying, they kind of like, you know, ultimately kind of emerge, I guess, at the same point, really, and kind of grow together throughout that time period. And there's sort of this like intrinsic link between the two of them. And that starts, I guess, with people like yourself.
Well, like I said, it was, you know, skateboarding's always gone hand in hand with music. You know, it's always fun to listen to your favorite music and skate, you know, and the people that were locals at the park would bring in music that was inspiring or influencing the scene and what we were into. And what got us really hyped up in skating And obviously, you know, like rock and roll definitely did, you know, but then it just started getting a little bit more kind of core and more like, you know, these people just wanting to start their own bands and not wait for like a mainstream label to pick you up. And so, you know, we just kind of, like I said, it was the whole DIY movement in the early 80s, you know, that sparked the interest of making a band, touring, making our own t-shirts, making our own stickers, and playing the music that we liked that was really high paced, driven, you know, rough around the edges, you know, music. And that's how skateboarding was, you know, it was gnarly. And so the music was gnarly as well.
Yeah. I think that I was listening to the Nines Club interview that you did, and you're really talking about the DIY aspect of early skateboarding, like the fact that there weren't shops for you to go and buy this stuff. So you're like looking in a magazine, scoping out the way someone's gear looked, and then trying to replicate it yourself. Like, it is really very DIY. And like you're describing your zine, like, you know, talking about finding skateboard spots, like you're finding illegal spots to skate at that point. Like, it is a real DIY. You're building a sport or building a lifestyle.
Well, the parks were closed. Like skateboarding got really popular in the mid 70s, where they started building skateboard parks all over the place. And then they only lasted about 2 or 3 years, and then they all shut down. So the hype of skateboarding was pretty high in the late 70s, and then it just died right in 1980. And at that time I was 15, and we were just kind of like, I had just turned pro, and I was in my rookie year, and then just everything just started kind of crashing down on itself. And I still was, it was early in my career. So I kind of wanted to still continue to skate. So I built my own ramp in my backyard, vert ramp, so I could keep up on my vert skills, and then started skating backyard pools, started skating street spots. And we just kind of skated wherever we wanted. But at the same time, we were going to punk shows, and I wanted to start a band, and I learned how to play bass. And so it was the lifestyle that we were living from like 1980, you know, 182 to 85, of just skateboarding wherever we could, and playing shows in the city, San Francisco, San Jose. I went on my very first US tours in a small band with my band, The Faction, in 1984. And I never even toured skateboarding before, but I brought my skateboard with me and I skated all these different spots. And then the next year I switched to guitar. And so we were a five piece and we did the same thing. We brought a band with us called The Drab. They were opener band from San Jose. And we did the same thing, toured the US again in a small van and skateboarded along the way. So, you know, that was, you know, we did that all on our own. We didn't have a label doing that for us. And our guitar player pretty much booked all our shows. I made t-shirts at my dad's shop and stickers and screened them myself. I would take them on tour to make money to eat on tour. And that was the lifestyle we were living, you know. And in the meantime, you know, there was little competitions here and there, backyard competitions that were happening. But, you know, and at that time we were still started making skateboard videos through Palo Peralta. So, you know, people were just starting to get VHS machines and able to like see skateboarding rather than just in the magazines. You could see it, you know, live on your TV, you know. So a lot of changes were going on within the sport of skateboarding, but also in punk rock, you know, and playing shows, playing with really, really cool bands, you know. I remember my first show I ever played was with Social Distortion in San Jose. That was 1982. We played with bands like Fear, JFA, The Exploited, TSOL, you know.
Well, how aware were you of like these other sort of skateboard bands? Like you mentioned JFA, like how aware were you guys in the beginning of like the big boys and like the fact that there were other kids around your age that were, you know, really identifying with skateboarding and punk rock and really trying to bring the two together?
Well, I remember doing a skate rock show for Trans World Magazine, and the big boys were on that as well. Aggression was on that. JFA was on that. So, you know, there was a lot of actually guys, you know, starting to start bands while they were skateboard pros and become musicians as well. And kind of like the two kind of went hand in hand, of either skate a session and then went to a gig that night. But the whole, you know, skate and destroy, skate rock, you know, Thrasher Magazine coined that when they made their first compilation tape, and we were able to be part of that in 1983. And then, you know, that's where the term skate rock, you know.
But you guys are kind of defining it, like you're saying, like you're doing a zine called Skate Punk prior to that, even, and like the, you know, and like you're saying, JFA and the big boys, it felt like there was this sort of like, obviously it's much more pronounced in California, but like it felt like there's almost this energy kicking off simultaneously around, you know, certainly around America around that time, where just like a lot of people were kind of like, really, like you're saying, like the lifestyle just seems to go hand in hand of meshing the two together. Like I think even before Thrasher codifies it, like you guys were kind of doing it on your own.
Pretty much, you know, JFA is what caught my interest in starting a band, because at that time I was, in around 1981, 82, I started, collecting records, and I'd go to this local record shop, and there was a 45 up on the wall, and there's a picture of a guy kick turning on a ramp with this band sitting on there. And I looked at the cover and it said JFA. And then I'm like, what does that stand for? It's like, I read the back. It's like, oh, Jody Foster's Army. Oh, these guys are skateboarders and they also play punk rock. So that's, I always tell Brian Brandon that, you know, they're the reason why I wanted to start the Faction, because I saw other skateboarders playing music, playing in punk bands, and I wanted to do the same thing.
I guess going back even before you're getting punk rock, what was the first concert you went to, or first, like, you know, live music you remember going to see?
First gig. I wouldn't say concert. I never went to any rock concerts or anything, but first gig I ever went to was Black Flag was supposed to play at Briner Hall in San Jose, and they never showed up. So it was a bunch of local bands that played before. But I remember listening to a spoken word of Henry Rollins saying that they were going to a show in San Jose and they broke down on the Grapevine. And that was a show that they were supposed to play. And I remember getting a Black Flag shirt from somewhere. And I'm super stoked to like see this band, you know, that I've been listening to on like 45s, and they never showed up. So it was a Black Flag show that I was going to.
Who are some like those local first wave bands from San Jose? Like, obviously I know, like, you know, as you're saying, the Drab and the Grim and sort of like your wave of bands, but like, who were the first wave?
Los Olvidados.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Was, one of them. There was Executioner, The Unaware. Who else? There was a rockabilly band called the Kingpins. We kind of played shows together as well, because those were skateboarders in that as well. There was Bay Area bands like Whipping Boy, Code of Honor from San Francisco.
Absolutely.
Social Unrest. There was, you know, a lot of local bands, you know, and those local scenes from San Francisco all the way down to San Jose was huge. And like I said, a lot of these guys were skateboarders. You know, a lot of guys I knew that in these bands, I'd seen them at the skate park earlier, and they started playing music, and, you know.
Yeah, like Code of Honor skated, right, I think?
Yeah, they did. They did as well.
It really does. Like you're saying, it feels like every town had a really kicking scene. Like, it's amazing when you look back on it. Like, it's almost like, I guess, 60s garage rock, where there was just like an explosion of youth energy, where just so many kids were starting bands, like hundreds of bands.
Well, yeah, I mean, we played, I remember the Faction played in Seattle and hearing about this band called Green River opening up for us. And lo and behold, two of the Goes guys that were in that band ended up starting Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. It's kind of cool, you know, it's kind of cool to hear that, you know, that we played with other bands that you know, became bigger bands as well. Oh,
it's amazing when you start getting into it, like where everyone went, you know, like mm-hmm. you look at the lineup for Mystic Records and how many people in bands on Mystic wound up doing other things, you know, or wound up, you know, involved in music in other places. Like you can connect Josh Brolin to RKL, you know, like it just feels like the mm-hmm. punk diaspora was immense where everyone went. Going back, IM Records was the Faction's label, right?
It was Adam's mom and Adam's label. They actually, you know, we wanted to put out our own record, and Adam's mom, who was a chiropractor at the time, said, "Hey, Adam, I'm going to give you some money to put your own record out." And so that became IM Records, you know. So Adam was the mastermind of making records, booking tours, you know, booking shows. I mean, he was basically kind of our manager as far as making things happen, you know. So I was just the talent, you know. I just went along for the ride, you know, and I was the, you know, the pro skateboarder that helped get people interested in the band, you know, because no one knew what who the Faction was. But when they heard that, you know, Steve Caballero, the pro skateboarder, was a part of that band, it made people want to come see the band. And you know, I was just learning how to play music. So each record got better and better because we got better at playing our instruments, you know. But it was definitely a learning experience going into the studio, recording, mixing, and selling records. And like, you know, I was selling our record, you know, in my zine, you know, putting my own ads and stuff in there. And then I think we got a few ads in Thrasher magazine too, trying to sell our first album. But yeah, it was just fun times, man. It's just innocent, fun times of just kids wanting to have a good time and just explore and be creative in any way that we could, whether it was skateboarding, it was music, it was art, you know. I started drawing back then as well, but I never really took it seriously until, you know, around 2005, I wanted to become a better artist. So, you know, I started putting in more of the work.
I've got like, you know, three kids now, and I really hope they have something like punk rock, because like, where else would you have as a young person, these sorts of skills, you know, really not just encouraged, but like sort of like, it's imposed upon you that you have to kind of do this stuff when you're involved in punk. Like you have to make a zine, you have to start a label, you have to help do shows. Like there's just so many skills that you acquire that through that. And obviously you get them through skateboarding too, but I don't know, just something about punk. Few places give that much responsibility to a young person.
Well, what I loved about skateboarding was it actually taught me how to fail to succeed. You know, it's not something that comes overnight and not something that someone's born with. You have to make a lot of mistakes in skateboarding to become successful. And so I used to bring that into anything that I participated in, whether it was music, whether it was art. I knew that I had to fail many times before I could be successful at it. So it really taught me a lot of life lessons being a skateboarder. And that's what I love about the sport of skateboarding is it toughens you up. It teaches you to be positive and look not so much at the process of it, but what you're going to gain at the end when you put so much passion and hard work into it. And from 1982, when I first picked up a bass, till now, I've been playing music my whole life, and I've been switching from back to bass and back to guitar. And I've done that with a few bands, and, you know, I feel like the current band that I'm in now, it's called Urethane. And I started out on bass with that last year, and 4 months into it, I switched to guitar. We got signed by a label, and I feel like I'm most proud of this project that I'm a part of. I feel like, you know, some people might say it's like an overnight success, but I feel like I put 40 years of hard work and labor into this band. Mm-hmm. And now people are starting to hear the, you know, everything that put into it now.
I think anyone that knows that you paid your dues in music, you know, and I think outside of the skateboarding too, I think the Faction records hold up, you know, like I think those records are completely independent of obviously all your achievements in skateboarding. They're like, they're classic punk records. They're classic hardcore records. Like No Hidden Messages is one of my favorite LPs ever. I think it rips.
You know? Well, Adam was a great, really good songwriter. You know, he came from a rock and roll background. He loved AC/DC. You know, everybody, you know, Gavin used to write really fun, catchy lyrics. But, you know, me and Adam, you know, worked together as far as writing music. And then we got another a bass player, Ray Stevens from Los Obedados, which added another element to the band. So we just always worked really well. But Adam, you know, always wrote, you know, really fun, catchy tunes. And it was all for fun. It wasn't really so serious, you know. Mm-hmm. Just having a good time. We're just kids, you know. And, you know, we've broken up. We've gotten back together. We've broken up, you know, ever since 1982 to just recently. We just played our last final shows before COVID-19 hit. And we decided to call it quits, you know, with the Faction. One being Ray had been ill, you know, and it was getting harder to play shows because we weren't sure what was going on with Ray. He was diagnosed with I think diabetes, but since then he's had some surgeries and he's had a liver transplant, you know, from his wife, and he's doing a lot better.
That's good.
But as far as musically, we've just kind of been playing the same songs over and over and over again. And I feel like it's a novelty, you know, and it's cool that people have never seen the Faction want to see the Faction play. But as a musician, I feel like I'm not growing, you know, creatively. You know, I'm just kind of like listening to the CD. Hey, you want to book a show? Yeah, I'll listen to the CD for a week and play the show, and it's a done deal. But I felt like I wasn't growing as an artist, so I kind of wanted to start a new band, you know, and with guys that were, you know, in my area, because the Faction's so spread out. You know, I'm here in San Diego, Adam's in Las Vegas, our drummer Keith is in Sacramento, and then Ray and Gavin, our singer, is in San Jose. So we weren't able to actually get together and practice and even try to write new songs. So to me, you know, that gets kind of old after a while. You know, I felt like I wasn't growing as a musician.
As the Faction goes on, there's kind of like this sort of darker, gothier kind of, not goth, but like, you know, sort of darker tone that comes in that really seems to get a lot more pronounced in Odd Man Out. Is that like somewhere that you were kind of getting into? Were you kind of getting into sort of like gothier music or darker kind of heavier stuff around that time?
Well, as soon as Faction broke up in 1985, I got together with our bass player from the Faction, and we just kind of started this whole new thing, and it just kind of grew organically, and we were just trying out all these different singers, and then one we found that could actually sing. You know, he kind of sounded like The Mission / The Cure / U2, and I was really fiddling around with different guitar sounds with digital delay and chorus, and that's where I started to really shine as a guitar player and writing music and stuff. And that was a different genre of music, you know. It was more Cure, U2 style, you know. And every time we'd play a show, we'd still get hooked up with punk bands. We'd be playing with the Adolescents and be playing with Suicidal Tendencies, and it's like they're expecting the Faction and they're getting Odd Man Out and not even the same style of music, you know. And that kind of lasted for a couple years. That was around 1987, 88. And I was touring a lot. I was going over to Europe doing contests and demos. And I remember our bass player, Ray, was getting a little bummed out that I was traveling so much and we weren't playing out. And so I ended up just quitting the band and said, okay, well, you know, maybe you guys should get another guitar player. And they just broke the band up after that.
I think that LP is amazing too. I think it's got like you're saying, your guitar playing, it's got some real cool, interesting stuff that you're doing on there.
Thank you.
And it feels like, I don't know, like it feels like it would have been at home with like, you know, later period or mid period TSOL or like Christian Death or like, you know, there's like a, there's definitely sort of this, it's still punk enough, but like, yeah, I can see why it wouldn't go over if people were expecting Suicidal.
Yeah. And then, you know, after that ended, you know, the grunge movement started happening around 1990, you know, and I started another band, and the singer that we ended up getting there, I started that band with a guy who was in a band called Mistaken Identity.
Oh yeah.
It was a punk band in San Jose, John Hall. And then I, with the drummer that I went to high school with, and then we found this guy, you know, Chris Landon, and he had a really strong voice, but it was very like Soundgarden, very, you know, Nirvana soundish. And the music was really, I was playing bass at the time, and our guitar player was, you know, writing a lot of the tunes. And so we kind of fit in that genre, the whole like Seattle sound. And that band was called Shovelhead. We put out a CD with that style of music. And I remember, once again, we still get hooked up with punk shows, you know, like Seattle rock and, you know, sound. And I remember I was playing this style of music, but I was always still listening to like NOFX and No Use for a Name and all these 90s punk bands, you know, Millencolin, MXPX. And I was like, man, I really want to start a punk band, you know, because I'm like, I'm listening to this style of music, but I'm playing this kind of music. So once again, I told our guitar player, I'm like, I'm leaving, I'm quitting, because I just, my heart's not into this music anymore. You know, I listen to punk, you know, and so that's when in 95 I started the band Soda, and that was a very melodic punk rock band with a female vocalist, you know. And like I said, I never always, like when I'd find vocalists for different bands, I wasn't always set on one sound. It's like if the first person that came that could actually sing, they were in the band. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's pretty much how it went. It was really organic. It was like, try out all these singers. Oh yeah. Okay. You can sing. Oh, it happened to be a female. Okay. You're in the band. That'll be kind of a different sound. It would kind of sound like the band Tilt.
Mm-hmm.
We actually played with Tilt back then in, you know, 95. And we played a couple of Warped Tour shows as well. Steve Paputis, who was in No Use for Name at the time, helped produce our album.
We did a split with them too, right? The session with 7-inch. There's a session split 7-inch with No Use for Name.
Yes,
too, right?
With No Use for Name. Exactly.
I remember buying that.
You've done your history.
Oh, no, I'm a record nerd. Like right now I'm at my wife's aunt's place, so you can't see. But normally when I record this, I'm surrounded by my, I guess this would be my children's albatross when I die, but my record collection, which is just a ridiculous amount of time spent listening to records. But yeah, no, definitely.
In between all those bands, we would do faction reunions, and then we'd break up, and then I'd start another band, do another faction reunion, until like the year 2000, we decided to form the faction again. That lasted 4 years, broke it up, and then got back together in 2012, and we played, you know, shows ever since then and up until now, you know.
People that are on the show that were around in LA, especially kind of like 84, 85 era, talk a lot about how, or just, I mean, California in general, all the way up to San Francisco, especially down to San Diego too, talk about the violence that came in and just how the scene kind of shifted and shows got a lot more kind of crazy, a lot more hairy. There were a lot more fights at shows and things like that. Is that something you noticed happening, or do you remember that?
Yeah. I mean, the reason why I think the faction broke up was the fact that the scene was terrible. And I want to say that because it was a skinhead scene roaming around San Jose that would come and just start fights at every show.
Yeah.
You know, I remember playing one of our last shows in San Jose State, and Lars, who is now in Rancid, I knew Lars as a little kid, a 10-year-old kid. He was friends with the Skinheads, and he said, "Hey, you know, I just want to warn you, the Skinheads are looking for you." I'm like, "Looking for me? For what? Like, what did I do?"
Yeah.
You know? And they just wanted to just cause havoc. And I remember there's video of like them trying to like spit on us while we're playing. I think it's like our fourth or fifth song. And then like Gavin, like flipping them off. And they would just always just try to cause trouble, you know? And I think we ended up stopped playing the show. And we just said, you know, the scene here the scene here sucks. They're just trying to ruin it for themselves, and there's no reason to play in a band here anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, was that after you guys had done your first sort of US tour, the 84 tour?
We did, we did the 84 tour, and then we did the 85 tour.
Okay.
And after the 85 tour, we were a little bit like, we were on the verge of breaking up as well too. Cause we weren't really getting along with our guitar player, Adam. You know, and we just, there were some differences in the band, and we just really wanted to call it quits. But then the Skinheads pretty much sealed the deal. Like, it's like, you know, we're going to play one last show, you know, and I think it was with Husker Du. We played up in Palo Alto, and it was one of those pay to play things where you pay, I think you like try to sell tickets.
Yeah, like Battle of the Bands type thing. Yeah.
Yeah, you sell tickets to play the show, and then you get them the money. And I remember we just sold all these tickets for the show, and then we just kept the money and just took off. we're like, we're not paying a club to play this place. They're paying us, you know?
Yeah.
So we just took off. And
sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, we just like, we'll probably never play this place again, but this is our last show, so who cares? I thought it was the weirdest thing. Like that, I never even heard of that pay to play thing.
I hear that happens a lot in LA. Like, I heard that's like a lot of the downtown Los Angeles sort of like clubs, like the big clubs that, you know, at a point were all pay to play, especially in the late 80s. Such a sleazy business, this music business. was there like sort of a delineation to you when sort of this new scene starts? Like, you mentioned all those bands that, you know, off the top, like No Use for a Name and things like that. Like, do you remember when you started seeing that sort of wave of bands start cropping up?
Yeah, mid-90s, you know, into the year 2000. I was on the band's Warped Tour, and a lot of those bands were touring. That, and I got into a lot of those bands, and you know, Face to Face, NoFX, MXPX, Mill and Collins, Strung Out, Pennywise, you know, up into Australia's Body Jar.
Yeah,
you know, all those bands were just super. It's the type of music that I liked, you know, and I think I liked them a lot because a lot of them are very melodic. You know, they had a punk energy to it, but it was very singy, very sing-along-y, you know, something that you can hum to and harmonize to. And that's the type of music that I kind of got attracted to and kind of fell in love with, you know. And still to this day, I love music, punk music that's melodic, you know. And so I love things with harmony, you know. Descendants were one of the very first bands that carried that, you know. Also the Misfits and, you know, Social Distortion. Those are really strong bands that really made an impact in my life. But I have to say that one of the biggest band from that era that made the hugest impact on me was Minor Threat. When they came on in, you know, early 80s, I was like, oh my goodness, this rocks, you know. This is high energy. This is I love what Ian McKay is doing here.
Did you see them on that when they came out to the West Coast?
I did. I got to see them at the On Broadway. I think it was 1983. was either 83 or 84. And I remember going to see them, driving up to San Francisco to go see them play. And my strongest memory of that show was the mic broke half the set, and he did not bother to get another mic. He just kind of like mouthed the whole song, because everybody in the hall were singing all the songs that they were playing. They knew them all. Mm-hmm. So he kind of like mouthing them while the crowd was singing them. It was amazing. I was just like, oh my goodness, this guy's singing, but he's not even singing. The crowd's singing all the songs for him. You know?
It's funny because like people always talk about how serious Ian MacKaye is, but when you watch footage of him, he's so performative. You know, like he does that sort of like when he's just so, I don't know, he's such a character on stage, you know, like, yeah. Like you're saying, like he's like lip syncing his own songs.
Yeah. And you know, it was rad. The energy that they had, they're the ones that made me want to get a Les Paul, you know, and play, you know. And we wrote some songs that I try to, you know, emulate what Minor Threat would, how they would play it, you know.
Yeah. You mentioned kind of getting the idea that you guys were going to break up after that last West Coast tour with the Faction. Why did you guys decide, though, to do the record with Mystic? Because you had done everything else on your own prior to. Was it just because you guys were wrapping up and you're just like, we needed somewhere to do this record?
I think that was one of the first labels that actually was attracted to the band. Mm. It was actually our first like, hey, someone's noticing our band and they're gonna pay for us to go down to LA and record an album, EP. So that was our closest thing to being signed by a label, you know, because we did everything ourselves, you know.
Well, that's the thing, because you guys, up until that record, everything, like you're saying, IM Records did everything, or
everything.
Your Faction Productions, even on that first tape comp.
Yeah, that was actually, what's funny about that compilation, that was the first recordings that we ever had. And the Faction Productions was the name of the guy who was running the thing. We didn't even have a name for our band. So that was before the Faction, like, you know, they basically said, hey, well, why don't you use this, you know, the Faction. But Faction Productions, it had nothing to do with the band. It was a guy producing the tape.
I always thought you guys were doing it, like when it said Faction Productions on the back of the records, I'm like, wow, this band's organized. They've got their own production company.
That was the guy, that's pretty much where we got our name from.
Yeah, that's awesome. That first tape is incredible. Like, obviously, only ever heard that on the internet, but just the range of bands. Like you mentioned the Drab.
That was a Growing Pains one, right?
Yeah, the Growing Pains tape. Which has like a Pusshead drawing on the cover.
Yeah.
I think even. But you mentioned the Drab, who went on that first tour with you, Brian Ray Turcotte, who fucked up and photocopied. And, you know, one of the great punk archivists of all time. But like, there's just so many great bands in that little scene. And there's, you know, that you mentioned Lars, there's that infamous photo of the Necros playing, I believe it's Gavin's backyard, is it?
Or no, our friend Ronnie that lived in Santa Clara, I think it was in Santa Clara, and Lars is like 10 years old.
Yeah.
And he was a big fan of our band, and we did, our drummer forgot his rug, so the bass drum kept moving forward, so the whole set, Lars is sitting in front of the drum bass to hold it there. Yeah. And it's, what's cool is we played with Rancid, I think up to a few years ago. And I think it was in San Francisco, and Lars did the exact same one. He did that photo. So we have a photo of that from 1984 or 83, I think it was, to 2020. You know, or 2019, I think it was, of Lars sitting in front of our drum, bass drum.
Must be a bigger bass drum at that point, too.
Yeah. So it's cool. It's cool to see, you know, him grow up. And I knew Lars would somehow make it in some kind of band, because he's always been true to punk. His the attitude, the look. I would see him like downtown and he's dressed up in, you know, spiked hair, leather jacket. And he just always lived it, you know? And finally he, you know, got into a band that you know, he fit right in too.
Well, it's wild the waves of people that you've kind of inspired, you know, like I've just, you know, like myself, you know, Lars, obviously before that, there's kids I have on this show that are younger than me. Kids are adults, but they're younger than me, but they talk about how they first got exposed to punk music by hearing Skate and Destroy on the Tony Hawk game, you know, like there's just, it's just amazing how this kind of carries on and keeps inspiring people, you know, like Urethane's going to be playing with bands that are like the fifth generation of people you've inspired now.
Probably. I mean, like I said, it's just really cool. I'm like, I'm just using all my connections that I've met all through my whole music industry, to make this project work. And you know, like I said, I'm very proud of this band. I hear nothing but good things about what we're doing. So I feel like we're on the right track. And I'm excited to just keep writing new music and getting to know these guys. I don't even know these guys very well. You know what I mean? I've only known them for less than a year, you know, but we wrote a great record with a great producer named Cameron Webb, who's worked with Motorhead. He's worked with Pennywise, Alkaline Trio, Strung Out. He's worked with his the history of bands that he's worked with and produced are amazing. So I think you'll enjoy what he's done with our record.
Oh, the record's fantastic. I was listening to it actually today and it's awesome. Like you're saying, like, you know, you've dedicated your life to music, and it's just as much as, you know, you've been skateboarding almost as long, you've been playing music in different bands. And
yeah.
Do you ever feel like the fact that you were skateboarding at such a high level, it sort of split your focus? Like a lot of people who come on the show, like Scott Radinsky from 10 Foot Pole will come talked about the fact that being a pro baseball player, you know, pulled him away from music in a certain way. Like you couldn't be focused on it. Did you find that too? Like you keep mentioning how, you know, you had bands, you'd have to leave a band at a certain point, or certainly with Odd Man Out because of touring.
Well, here's a scenario that happened. So when I started Soda, I started that from scratch. I built a music studio in my backyard in 94, and I hooked up with a drummer, then in turn finally found a bass player, and then he brought his guitar player, and then we found a singer after that. And as soon as we were established writing songs, playing, we put out our first demo tape that we recorded by ourselves. I get C. Paputas calling me and saying, hey, we need a guitar player to join No Use for a Name. Do you want to be in the band? And I just started Soda. So I would have to make a choice of rather going like, I just started this band. We're just starting to play. We got, you know, and I'm going to leave you and go to No Use for a Name and go on tour. And I just looked at my career. I was like, I'm still a professional skateboarder. And I felt bad, like, leaving this project that I started. And I was like, yeah, I had to say no to Paputas, you know, and tell him, thank you for the offer. I would love to be in the band, but it's just not in the cards for me right now. And they ended up getting Chris Shiflett. Mm-hmm. To play and sing and what way better choice than me, way better guitar player, better singer. He fit the band really well. And then Chris went off to play in the Foo Fighters as well. So, you know, that was a fork in the road. That was a choice I had to make. I mean, I could have probably said bye to Soda, put the skateboard career on hold and join No Use for a Name and go on tour with them. You know, but I decided not to.
Well, yeah, because it's just, you know, I guess it's a sweet problem to have where you have these two things in your life that could be kind of your focus. But at the same time, like it must be at certain points, like you're saying, it's frustrating when you have these options in front of you that you'd have to shuttle your whole skateboarding career to be in a full-time band like that. Like No Use for a Name was a full-time band, right?
Yeah, they toured a lot. And I looked at that and I'm like, and being married at this at that time too, it's like, I don't know if that's going to work out, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not married now, so I can go on tour as much as I want. So now, I'm single.
Yeah, at this point in your life, you can finally you can do the 3 months of touring and be okay with it and stuff like that. What was the deal with Super Cool Tough Guys?
That was a pretty cool little project that me and Tommy Guerrero put together. We were at skate camp in Visalia, 1987. And I had this little four track that I would mess around in between like Odd Man Out and Shovelhead and write my own songs. And I brought it to skate camp with me. And I had Tommy Guerrero bring his guitar and drum machine. And I brought mics and my bass. And we wrote the song together. And we called it Super Cool for Steve Caballero, Tough Guys, Tommy Guerrero. And we wrote the song in our dorm room at Visalia Skate Camp. And we showed it to Thrasher. And they loved it that they put it on a flexi disc. And they did it as a giveaway for Thrasher Magazine.
Yeah, no,
I have a stack of those still somewhere.
When you go on tour, you got to make covers for them, and you can sell them on the merch table.
I know. It's pretty cool. It's a really cool thing. So Tommy programs a drum machine. I play bass and sing, and he plays guitar on that. Yeah.
Was there ever talk of doing more stuff with that, or is it just that one flexi, like one-off project type thing?
It was a one-off project thing that me and Tommy messed around with, you know, because Tommy had been in bands just as long as I had. When I was playing in the Faction back in the day, he was playing in a band called Free Beer with his brother. Yeah, Tony Guerrero. So Tommy's been playing music pretty much his whole life as well, and he's an established musician, you know, and a skateboard company owner.
Once again, it's just there's so many prolific artists doing all sorts of stuff, be it, you know, businesses or music stuff at this time. Are there any bands that you kind of look back upon that you wish had more focus or that had more attention? Like, you know, obviously Minor Threat's legendary and there's a lot of legendary bands, but are there any bands that, you know, didn't maybe get records out in the way that they should have, you think, or that you saw back then?
Not really. I mean, I can't speak for any other bands, you know, or what I wish they did. I mean, I'm bummed that Minor Threat broke up so early because I just loved what they were doing. But obviously Ian McKay's heart wasn't into it. You know, I think the way it's gone, I'm happy with the way it's gone and what has come out and the music that was produced in the early 80s. To the 90s to 2000. I'm proud of being part of that scene to the point where Fat Mike from NoFX and Fletcher from Pennywise are putting together this project. They're starting this museum in Vegas. And I got an email from Fat Mike having him wanting me to be a part of it and him mentioning saying like, you know what, dude, he's like, the Faction means so much to me. He's like, it influenced me to play music, to be in this band, NoFX. And you are a huge influence and inspiration to what I do. So I want you to be a part of this punk rock museum. So that meant a lot to hear that from him, you know, and how successful he has been. And the fact that this band that we did, I mean, the band was together from 82 to 85 and we toured in a small van for 2 years straight or 2 years with a month each time and just playing gigs here and there and a couple, you know, shows up and down the coast, getting paid $50, $100, but nothing really major. Those times were very innocent and very influential that we didn't even know what kind of effect this little skate rock band was having on people. But, you know, it did touch some lives.
No, the whole way through too. Like, you know, not just the faction, but like Odd Man Out. Like, you've done it. You know, like, I have so much respect for your career in music because it's always been rooted in the sort of punk rock world, but you've done so many different things, and you've done, you know, you've done all these different styles and evolved with this thing, but you've always done it independent. Like, no one can accuse you of trying to cash in on the music side of things. Like, you know, like from Soda going back to the faction, like, it's always DIY.
Yeah. And that's because maybe the bands didn't last long enough, or what wasn't at the right time, right place at the right time to get noticed by a label. But to be honest with you, any kind of musician playing music for a living, they want to get signed. They want to do the touring. They want to become successful. And it's not about selling out. It's about cashing in and being successful and all the hard work you put into something that people recognize you for that, you know. Obviously we did it for fun, but you know, work is work, you know, and to get paid for it, it's beneficial, you know. A lot of time goes into writing music, a lot of time goes into practicing twice or three times a week, and you're dealing with drama, you know, personalities, and you're dealing with time constraints and people's egos and learning to get along with each other. It's a lot of work, you know, and I find that for me, if I'm in a band, I don't care how good of a musician you are, I have to get along with you. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to work well with you. And I've tried starting bands here and there that I just felt like, you know what, it's not going anywhere. It doesn't flow right. And I'm just going to say goodbye. You know, I like to like seize opportunity. And when I see something's not going in a positive direction, I steer away from it, you know, and that's how I make better choices and less drama and less stress in my life, you know?
Yeah. Like, it's better to be with great people than it is to be with great players in a lot of times. Like, you know,
for sure. It was a very humbling experience to see that Metallica documentary, Some Kind of Monster. Mm. You know, that really blew my mind. I really was like, whoa, a band like Metallica goes through the same hardships and same struggles as a small little band starting up. They are dealing with the exact same issues. Mm-hmm. Just on a, you know, they're just more famous, more money, but same issues, same problems, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's like outside of a marriage, like how many more intense relationships are there than being in a band with someone? You're like living with them.
It's tough. I think being in a band is more tougher than being in a single relationship. You're dealing with four or five different personalities.
Yeah. You know? Polyamorous nightmare.
Yeah. And so when we started this band, Urethane, I wanted to keep it small, you know, because less people, less drama. But, you know, I just had this wild hair of wanting to play guitar again. And I just love the sound of guitar and the tones and the energy it brings. And I felt like the band would be so much better if we had two guitars complementing each other, you know. So that's why we became a four-piece. And I'm glad that our singer can sing and play guitar, because that cuts one less person out of the picture.
And a lead singer, a guitarless lead singer, is the most dramatic person you can have in a band, as we all know, right?
Yeah. Like, well, yeah, and he's a great songwriter too. So he wrote, you know, a lot of these songs. Our bass player brought some songs to the album as well. And you know, I've only brought, you know, my influence to the band and the sound, but hopefully on the next record I can have some songs that I wrote myself, but I wrote a bunch of the licks and hooks in this one, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've kept you for a while, Steve, and I could talk to you forever, and anytime you want to come back on here and talk about this stuff, please know the door is always open.
Appreciate it.
But before I let you go, can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
How many issues of Skate Punk were there, and will you reissue it?
Skate Punk zine ended up probably four issues. And then after Skate Punk, I created, well, see, what happened was Skate Punk was a Xerox little magazine. And then I started with our singer from the Faction and his brother, Gavin and Coy O'Brien. And because my dad owned a print shop, I started half-toning the photo. He wanted me to, my dad's on, it'll look so much better if you just half-tone the photos. And if you type out the stuff instead of writing it out. So I started doing that, and the little zine started looking like a magazine.
Yeah.
You know? And I could tell, like, Gavin and Coy weren't into it. And then I started putting skimboarding in there, snowboarding in there. And he's like, they're like, what is this? This isn't an Action Now magazine. Like, this was skate punk. It's supposed to be skate and punk rock. And me being open-minded, I just wanted to keep doing this. So they went off and started their own zines called Skate and Zine. And so I continued skate punk by myself. And by the fourth issue of skate punk, it just got very overwhelming with half-toning photos, typing everything, trying to get ads and everything, that I just went, I'm done with that, and I want to go back to the original way I did skate punk. And I started speedzine, just putting photos on there and writing stuff out. And I think we did up to 9 issues of speedzine. And the very, very last issue of speedzine, color copies came out. I don't remember when the first color copier came out. There's a cover of John Gibson from Texas, and I forgot who else was on that, but it was a color Xerox copy zine.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'd never seen one of those ever. And I was so excited to show the world, like, check this out. Yeah, it's a color copy zine.
That's awesome. Well, you got it. Wow. If you ever do want to reissue it, I think you'd have one buyer right here. I'm first in line for this.
Thanks. I still have a lot of the mock-ups, the original mock-ups of all these, of the speed zines. Yeah.
Oh, it's just begging you to do it.
Yeah. We've done some zine shows where I've shown some of the mock-ups. The guys dedicated these art shows to, like, the invention of the zine, mm-hmm. You know? So we showcase a couple skate punks and speed zines in there.
Well, when that book comes out, you got to come back on the show.
Okay.
Thank you, Steve, for coming on the show. And I look forward to that skate punk book coming out. How wild is that? He originated the term skate punk, which is now just part of the lexicon, right? Like, we're all just, like, you know, familiar with that term. But, like, it had to come from somewhere. Came from Steve Zine. That was awesome. Once again, please check out Urethane's brand new record, Chasing Horizons, coming out on September 24th over on Cybertrax. And you can pre-order that now and get ready for that thing to drop. It's fantastic. I've listened to it, as you heard in the interview. And, you know, as I say, it continues Steve's legacy as a sort of punk rock journeyman. Also, you know, the skateboarding thing, too. Speaking of things I'm excited for, next week on the show, it's a big one. It's a huge week here. It is Negative Approach Week. That's right, because we will have 2 members from the Negative Approach family joining me on the show. First of all, a live interview that I recorded with Chris O.P. Moore, as he is famously known, who was the original drummer, well, not the original, the second drummer of Negative Approach, but the one who played on the 7-inch and the LP. He also plays in incredibly incredible Crosswires. Before that, he played in Youth Patrol. He is one of the sweetest people I know, and I'm so happy that I finally get to play this interview for you, because also, I've been holding off on playing this one because I knew we were going to have this other interview coming up, and it'll be dropping on Friday with my Frank Sinatra, the vocal god, John Brannon, will be coming on the show, because finally, this to me is one of the great lost recordings of all time in punk rock. Finally, Third Man Records will be releasing to the world John Brannon's first band, The Static. And these recordings have been talked about and theorized about and pontificated on by myself for years, but by many people for years. And we get into it on the next episode. But oh my gosh, am I excited for you to hear not just Chris's episode and John's episode, but these recordings, because I've heard them and they live up to all the hype. Okay. I'm jumping for joy. You get to hear this next week. I'm excited for next week's episodes. Oh boy. Oh boy, oh boy. But that's it for today's episode. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous peoples matter. We need to protect trans kids. We need to help trans people protect themselves. We need to stop hate and violence towards Asian people and people of different faiths, and just knock all that shit off. Once again, this isn't political stuff. This is just basic human rights stuff. There's other stuff that's political, and you can talk about all that stuff as well. But this stuff is just basic human rights stuff. So, you know, fuck off to all the Nazis, all the fascists. We don't need them. We don't need them at all. We also respect the women's right to choose, or people with uteruses' rights to choose. We respect people's freedom of choice here. And that has always been the case and will always be the case. So please get involved. Look at organizations that are doing good work. Look at organizations that are fighting to make the world a better place. Donate your time, donate your body to protests. Call that fucked up abortion tip line and flood it. Flood it with fake information right now in Texas, you know, because we got to shut this shit down. Because the thing is, this isn't just an American thing. This shit spreads. This shit spreads. And in Canada, it spreads to us. We see it time and time again. What happens in America eventually comes to Canada, and we got to shut this shit down now. So get involved. Get involved. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you're not going to need them. You know, they're just dead weight at that point. So you can give someone else a new lease on life. So why not do it? Why not? Speaking of things you may want to do, you know, why not try and do something creative? Make your own culture, start a band, start a fanzine, start just drawing pictures. You know, it doesn't have to be something you show to the world. It just could be for yourself. But I promise you, it will help you with your mental health. And then if you decide to wind up doing it professionally, it might hurt your mental health. But in the immediate, though, it will help with your mental health. You might want to also try meditating, because I didn't believe in that shit at all. And now I try, and I find for me it's helped. So maybe it'll help you too. Who knows? Who knows? And that's it. I will see you next week for Negative Approach Week. Oh my gosh, am I excited. And that's it. Bye. Thanks for listening.